Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Okay, that's better. Good. Now that that testing is over, my name's Hugh Morris. I have the pleasure of being the chairman of the board of MITAX. And it's my real pleasure this afternoon to welcome you all here to the third annual general meeting of MITAX Network, a meeting which is, I understand, setting record attendance numbers. I believe we have over 350 registered delegates and counting. So on behalf of all the local community of MITAX, to those who have come from out of town and indeed from long distances away, I'd like to extend a special welcome and brag a little bit that we managed to produce some of the weather which Vancouver is famous for, at least for a couple of hours this afternoon. It's not my job to talk to you, but I do have, on behalf of Arvind, a couple of logistic announcements I have to make. I'd like to remind all MITAX investigators, all MITAX researchers here, that we would like them to cast their votes for their representative on the board, a most valuable presence and insight, so please don't forget that. Should be done by 4 p.m. on Friday, tomorrow afternoon, please. You can get the ballots at the registration if you have not already received them in your packages. I'd like to invite all MITAX members also to attend the business meeting, 4:15 on Friday afternoon in lecture room number 2. Again, please, we'd like to have feedback and input and comments from all the members. And perhaps most important, at 1:15 on Saturday, the 25th, a student meeting. And they have not given me the benefit of knowing where that takes place, so you'll have to catch somebody at the reception desk to find out where that's going on. I'd now like to ask Dr. Nasif Gassoub, the director of the Pacific Institute for Mathematical Sciences and one of the founders and instigators of the MITAX network, to introduce our speaker.
It's a pleasure and honor for me to introduce Gilbert Strang. Gilbert Strang was an undergraduate at MIT and a Rhodes Scholar at Balliol College in Oxford. Obviously, he was a good student because now he's an honorary fellow at Balliol College and he's a professor at MIT. Gilbert Strang has been a Sloan Fellow and a Fairchild Scholar. He's a Fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, and he's an outstanding mathematician, an applied mathematician. He wrote several books in linear algebra and applied math, well-known, including books on wavelets and filter banks. He served as president of SIAM for 2 years, for 99 and 2000. And today's talk will be on filtering and signal processing. And this is Gilbert Strang.
I think one more step here electronically.
Okay, that's on.
Okay, watch it if you pick this one up.
Okay. Let's see, does the mic work? Yeah, okay. First step of signal processing. Okay, so thank you for inviting me, and wonderful to be in Vancouver. And especially at a time, a kind of burst of energy in applied mathematics that's just terrific. So I suppose the background of my subject is the general feeling that this is a century, we're starting a century, you could say almost a century of data that data is now being collected at a totally at orders of magnitude faster than before. So where statistics might have, the statistician might have worked to get 20 samples or 50 samples process. Now, if you go for an MR scan or something, I mean, millions or billions of bits come in no time at all. So the rules are completely different. And what do we do with data? I'm not sure I'll think of all the things that we need to do. Let me just write a few of them. Let's see. I'll put first the topic of smoothing data. So data I should put first. Right. Okay. So what to do with it? Well, my talk will be about one step, which is smoothing, to somehow remove the noise without removing the signal. So that's the goal of that process. Another major topic that's just sort of central in so much of applied mathematics is how do you represent it? How do you represent the underlying function that you're trying to identify? So you're representing functions, let's say. So there, certainly, the answer that Fourier gave us as a combination of sines and cosines is, I mean, that's always going to be the number one answer, I think. But not, it's perfectly appropriate for smooth functions. It's probably unbeatable. But then now we have a lot of situations where our functions have discontinuities. And there we know that the Gibbs phenomenon occurs, that the Fourier series converges very slowly, far too slowly to take all the terms that would be required, and a different representation. Well, I was involved a little bit with wavelets. So that's one idea. That's a class of functions that's good for piecewise smooth representations that's good for piecewise smooth data, piecewise smooth functions. But then I don't know if you follow all the recent developments. It's hard to keep up. So wavelets are not so great for images that have edges, and of course edges are a crucial aspect of images. So people invent appropriate new functions to include together with wavelets. With jumps, wavelets are a useful possibility. And now with edges and images, can you read my writing more or less? Okay. Well, just to mention some of the words, just so you see. So there are edgelets, of course. We could think of let's think of some new ones. Okay. First, let me write down the ones we know. Curvelets, these bandlets. You see the rhyming nature of this subject. What else? I'm missing one or two. Ridgelets, thanks. Ridgelets. Now, let me give one while I'm just speaking generally, and then I'll be doing math most of the talk. But let me... yesterday in my office came a guy with a class of problems about how to represent terrain. So geography. And geography, really, geographers don't have substantial mathematical training in many cases, but now they can get this data. So they are going to need appropriate functions to represent things like terrain. How would you represent the Vancouver area? And it will have discontinuities, and at least in slope. And so we'll need... It's just a fascinating problem. Or how do you represent people's faces for photographs? So it occurred to me just in the minutes before, will you forgive this awful pun, but I propose that for terrain, cutlets would be a good one. But I have no definition. I figure the first step is to think of the word, right? And then, well, next year, come up with a function. Okay. So that's that business of representation is crucial. And then maybe I put classification, and by no means am I going to have a complete list here. So classification would come into issues, well, in genomics. You have to decide, you know, what kind of a gene have you got? Have you got a gene? So that's a... Anyway, you see my point. This is going to be an exploding area, and medicine and biology are going to be very heavy contributors to this, where physics and parts of engineering have been the principal contributors in the past. Okay, so can I now concentrate on this question of smoothing? And use a very basic model problem just as a kind of to fix the idea. So that's two sets of samples, both based on a Gaussian. And in the upper one, there's Gaussian plus noise. That's my sample. Gaussian plus noise. So it's a very simple model to think about. And in this case, the noise, the sigma, the variance of noise was set only half. Here sigma was doubled. We've called it 10% noise. So you can see that the oscillations, the error from the correct Gaussian is significantly greater. So what's our job? Our job is, given these samples, you can see, right, the sample values that are coming from the data. We have to smooth them. We want to remove the noise, which is typically high frequency, right? So I'm thinking of a low-pass filter. So a low-pass filter is a filter that lets low frequencies through, these nice smooth Gaussians, but annihilates, or mostly annihilates, high frequencies, which the noise represents. But of course, there's high frequency in the Gaussian too. So we don't want to overdo it. So that's always the trade-off in smoothing. You want to reduce the noise but not flatten out the whole signal. So it's what should that balance be? And also the question of how do you do the smoothing? What's the method? And now I'm going to speak mostly about linear filters. But because we can carry the analysis much further, and in many situations, linear filters, they're fast, very convenient, and in many situations, totally adequate. But then there will be other situations in which the restriction to a linear filter is not so great, and nonlinear filters. So a lot of people who maybe work in nonlinear partial differential equations, they see nonlinear filters as the right way to go. Okay, so I'm interested in both. Okay, so may I? So linear, low-pass filters. How do they work? Okay. So you know the model. Now, what do we do with it? Let's call. Okay, so here's a. In one page, maybe the typical central ideas in low-pass filters. Okay, so what's what? This X of N is the set of samples. Those values that sort of climb the Gaussian and climb back down. That's the input, the data. I'm going to speak about some very specific filters that were proposed by Savitsky-Golay. So I'll use the letters SG for what I'm speaking about, this particular filter. And, well, being an honest person, I have to say these filters are not fantastic. I'm not putting them forward as the filters to go and use. You'll see that they're very natural filters to think about, to understand, and to improve on. Okay, so, and this is the output. Okay, so, but let's, this transparency contains the central little bit of algebra that's at the heart of filtering, signal processing. Okay, so we take the input and we look. If we want the output at position M, then, well, this is going to be a symmetric filter. So at position little m, we look cap M on each side. So we have altogether two capital M plus one samples. And we give them weights. Or Savitsky-Golay gave them weights. Or whoever creates a filter gives them, assigns weights. So this is the decision is what shall these coefficients be? What shall the filter coefficients be? Okay. And whatever we choose, then we just execute this sum to get each output. And then when we want the next output at the next point, then we're looking, well, do you see that somehow it's a window of values? Maybe that's worth drawing on this before I go further. So we might take there's a window of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 values in that window. So that would be a case of capital M equal to 2, right? 2 on the left of center, 2 on the right of center, 1 in the center. And those 5 values, we would take, we would weight them. A mean filter would weight them equally. The weights would all be 1/5. In that case, the output at the center would be 1/5 of each of those 5 samples, the sum of the average of those 5 samples. The mean is the average. Okay. So that would be a low-pass filter, right? Because how do you see that that's a low-pass filter, that mean filter? Well, if we had a really low frequency, like just a steady, constant level, like the patient was dead and the result is just constant, then, of course, that's going to be passed through, reproduced perfectly. When we average that constant, we'll stay at the constant. Whereas if we had a high frequency, then we'd see some cancellation, and the result would be that averaging smooths the data, right? That the output Y would be smoother than this input. But it would flatten out the top of the Gaussian, which is probably what actually, these Savitsky-Golay were using their filters, using the filters for spectroscopy and looking for spectral lines, and they really wanted to know, okay, where is the center of that Gaussian? Okay, so you see how a filter works, and now do you see this picture of a sliding window? If you've worked with filters, this is familiar. The next thing, we would slide the window over by one, so that sample is no longer used. This one, this one, this one, this one, and wherever the next one is, maybe there. Those five samples, we would take weights, their averages or their weighted averages, and that would be the output at the next center point. Do you see that that's what I've tried to draw there, what this formula is expressing? And that's such a fundamental operation that it has the name convolution and the symbol sort of a star. So the output is the convolution of the input with the filter, with this set of numbers, which would be called the impulse response. Now, why the impulse response? An impulse to an engineer is suggesting a delta function. A single sample is one and all the rest are zero. That plays a central role in the whole thing. So suppose the x's were the delta vector, one and otherwise all zero. Then what would come out? Then this would be a convolution of the filter coefficients with that delta guy, and what would come out would be the filter coefficients. The delta acts like a 1 in convolution. If you convolve with the delta function, you get back whatever you convolved with. And so I'm just really saying why the words impulse response. Part of applied math, and not the least important part, and not the least difficult part, is the language. So anybody, I mean, you, like many of you probably have moved into problems in biology, so you'll know better than I that connecting the language of applied mathematics with the language of science, with the application, is quite serious. So anyway, impulse response. Okay, now I said there was a really key bit of algebra here, which is that any time you see a convolution, well, together with a Fourier transform, a Fourier idea, do you know what the convolution rule is? The convolution rule says that if I take Fourier transforms, I guess this displays what I mean by Fourier transform. Out of these samples, I create a function. Out of these numbers, create another function. Out of these outputs, create another function. And that's the discrete time Fourier transform. I'm going to from discrete numbers to a function, the opposite of what Fourier series usually does. Okay, so if I just define the transform this way, these functions, x of omega, sg of omega, y of omega, then the beautiful rule is, and you'll know it, but what I'm really saying it for is to emphasize its tremendous importance, is that convolution becomes multiplication. Convolution in one domain is multiplication in the other. That's, you know, it's in every book on Fourier series, it's in every course, but it isn't maybe always emphasized as it deserves to be. Okay, so low pass means that if the input is all ones, the output is all ones. Then the zero frequency goes straight through. So that's the omega equals zero. This is omega equals zero. And the transform of the all ones thing is just a one, and the output being one, so we know that it got multiplied by one. Oh, let me just jump to the main point. Every guy in filters is going to draw a picture. The filter coefficients, which is what we're interested in, these numbers. One way to understand them is make a function out of them and graph the function. It's the function we make is this transform guy. So do you see that represents that when we've graphed it? That represents a low-pass filter. Why? Because at low frequencies, the function is 1. So we're multiplying by 1, and that frequency is not changed. At high frequencies, the function is 0. We're multiplying by 0, and that highest frequency is gone. And all the other frequencies in between are reduced to some degree. Now, what I've drawn there is that's a frequency response that would not impress. In fact, it would depress anybody creating filters. That's a very gradual transition. I mean, that shows a lousy filter. It's true it's a low-pass filter, but a much better filter would be choose these numbers so that the graph is much more 1 or near 1. It can't be if it's a perfect constant, it will always be constant. So it'll ripple a bit. And then dive down. And then 0 there. Okay. I hope that anybody who's expert in this subject will forgive my sort of graphical heuristic description of a low-pass filter. Okay. But now you see how this is the crucial function, this function SG of omega. Well, I'm using SG because I'm have in mind the Savitsky-Golay filter. Okay. But now what's the Savitsky-Golay filter? And what's the plan? Okay. May I maybe use this to give an indication of what the idea of the talk is? Okay. So the title is Smoothing by Fast Polynomial Filters. So whatever polynomial filters are, they're a specific class of filters. And not, as I said, not necessarily the best. Okay. So the first point was to talk about what low-pass filters are. That's done. Now the second point is to say what are these specific SG filters that I plan to talk about. Okay. And it's joint work with MIT grad student Per-Olof Persson. And the idea behind these filters is just least squares. So that's what I'm going to explain next. Where do least squares come in? And anywhere least squares comes in, you figure you can understand that. I mean, it's the formulas are nice, and we should be able to get somewhere with it. So these filters have been used in spectroscopy, but in looking at it, we realize that actually, and I'll explain this, that Chebyshev, off in Russia 150 years ago, did critical little bit of mathematics with orthogonal polynomials. That's perfect for this problem. And then we realized that it's the Chebyshev polynomials I'm referring to are not the most famous Chebyshev polynomials, but another family of, you'll see, discrete ones. And then we thought, well, those are so close to Legendre polynomials being really famous from least squares, we thought, you actually should use those. So we've ended up recommending a simpler family than Savitsky-Golay. And then the applications part. One part is, can we execute them faster than this formula would expect? So what does that formula Let me call 2m plus 1, which is the number of coefficients. Let me just call it n for short. Then every output needs n multiplications and additions. And that's normal, and it can be executed very fast. But with these particular filters, there's a much faster way. So it's a bit like the FFT, the fast Fourier transform. There's a normal way to do it, and then there's a super fast way to do it, which I'll show. Okay, so I'll leave that outline of the talk and get going. Okay, so now my main job is to say what these particular filters are. We've got the idea of what the problem is and the idea of what low-pass filters are, but now what are these? How are these particular coefficients chosen? Okay. And the underlying principle is least squares. And they're described in numerical recipes. There's a MATLAB code that executes them very slowly. The MATLAB itself, you probably all use MATLAB, and now it's associated with Maple, so what has the best? The Savitsky-Golay is in a MATLAB toolbox, and some of the codes in MATLAB toolboxes are not the greatest. So that's the implementation issue. My goal now is really to say, what do you do in each window? What's the output at the middle of the window? And there in a box is the rule. So here's the Savitsky-Golay idea. You take those five samples, you fit them with a polynomial. Let's say a polynomial of degree. So we got 5 points, we fit them maybe by a polynomial of degree 2. So this would be a typical but short, quick Savitsky-Golay filter. Take the five values, fit them by a parabola, and take the output to be the middle of the parabola, the center, the point at the center of the parabola. Okay, so can I follow through on that example? That particular example with capital N equal 5 points, degree 2, just to see specifically what the linear algebra is. Because it is pure linear algebra, least squares. So there's a picture of five values, parabola between, taking this value. And then here's the picture that's crucial. Let the five values be 0, 0, 1, 0, 0. Take the delta vector. Figure out the parabola that best fits a delta. Then the five values of that parabola will, with a little bit of algebra, turn out to be the five coefficients we're after. So if I want to know what are the Savitsky-Golay coefficients, I input a delta, I fit that one, and that tells me everything. So you see the math problem. What's the best least squares approximation to a delta? And it's reasonable that that problem would have been studied a long time ago. And I'm still discovering, and I'd be grateful for any new references on that specific calculation. The best least squares approximation to delta. That's what's behind this. Okay. So how do you do that? Let's just suppose we... Let me just take that as a linear algebra problem. Five equations. The parabola is going to be c naught plus c1x plus c2x squared. So it has three coefficients in the parabola. 5 points that we would like to fit, 0, 0, 1, 0, 0, at the points minus 2, minus 1, 0, 1, 2. And, of course, we can't fit it exactly. So we can't get, is that, I don't know if that's an equality sign, but I hope not. Let's make it slightly not. Okay. Now, do you know the name of this matrix that's coming in? It's when you're fitting polynomials at equally spaced points, or even at unequally spaced points, but here equally, it's Vandermonde. So we're looking at a Vandermonde matrix. And how do you do least squares problems? Okay. Well, one way to solve least squares problems, and this is the way the numerical recipes code does it, is to, if you want to solve VC equal delta, it's which is overdetermined, rectangular matrix, then you solve the normal equation V transpose V, which of course is a symmetric great matrix, 3 by 3 here, C equal V transpose delta. You multiply both sides of the equation by V transpose, and that gives you the best least square solution. Okay, so that's one way to do it. Probably the way you would do it if you had one problem to do. But if you're going to do a lot of these, there's a different way. So I'm speaking really here about the fundamental problem in numerical linear algebra. The other way is you orthogonalize the columns of the matrix. Because if you have an orthogonal set of functions, columns, or then this least squares problem breaks apart into one-dimensional problems, then it's a cinch. So the natural idea is, well, look, that column is already orthogonal to that column, right? Orthogonality means that the dot product of the two columns is zero. And you see, if you form the dot product, you have minus 2, minus 1, 0, 1, and 2, and they add to 0. Just the way 1 is orthogonal to x on a symmetric interval. But it's not orthogonal to the squares. So this, because of course this column is 4, 1, 0, 1, 4, and its inner product with that one is 10 or something, not 0. Okay. So you orthogonalize, and that's where this Gram-Schmidt comes in, and it's known in linear algebra as QR. And let's just do it for this example. So this column is not orthogonal to this one, but the Gram-Schmidt idea is subtract off a suitable multiple of that to get a column that is orthogonal to that. You know the Gram-Schmidt idea that here we have the column of all ones. Here we have this column. They're not orthogonal. So Gram-Schmidt says, take away the component in the all ones direction and leave yourself the orthogonal component. Then this will be the good second vector. That's the vector that Chebyshev found for any size, any n here. Okay. So now we have, in using the new function, we have orthogonal columns. The answer can be found one at a time. I won't even write, I'll write down a formula later. But the result is that that 1/5 is the coefficient, is the constant. 0 is the linear, because we have an even function. We don't expect any odd stuff to enter. And minus 1/7 is the coefficient of this Chebyshev guy, x squared minus 2. Why x squared minus 2? Because this was x squared minus 2 that gave the orthogonal one. Do you see that? This is one example, but it's all in this example. And one more thing in this example, if you can follow one more. So that's the best. That's the answer. That's the best. That, if I evaluate that at the 5 points, I get the picture that we drew before of the best parabola fitting the delta. And now it would be great to have, we want a formula for these, and Chebyshev produced it. And then we would also like a formula for the final result. Okay, and that's the sort of exciting point. Let me reach that formula for this. Watch what happens. Suppose I go on to the next column, the cubes, and I orthogonalize that. So I'm looking at the next Chebyshev polynomial. So what the cubes, minus 2 cube, minus 1 cube, up to 2 cube, that will automatically be orthogonal to what? Well, it's automatically orthogonal to the constants and the quadratics. The cubes are the odd power. So the one it's not orthogonal to is this one. And so there it is, and there I've subtracted off enough of the linear. So it's an x cubed minus 17 fifths x. That's the next Chebyshev polynomial. So you now see the whole picture of Chebyshev's construction, that he got 1x, x squared minus 2, x cubed minus 17 fifths. But what else do you notice? You notice that this x cubed minus 17 fifths x is exactly some constant times x times this one. In other words, if I divide this by x, I've got the answer. Right now it's like, is that an accident? But in orthogonal polynomials, there are no accidents, I suppose. So that will be the general formula. That's the formula that is coming up here. That we have an explicit formula for Savitsky-Golay. It's the n plus first Chebyshev polynomial divided by x and with a constant. And then, well, here I could go quickly. Well, I better see what's on the next transparency. Okay, it's Chebyshev. Can you? I'm by no means the right person to talk about classical polynomials. I'm too young, but I don't know anything about them. That's an important thing. But this little bit of work has convinced me that there's something to them. So this was Chebyshev's formula for his discrete, the best discrete approximation. You see, when I say discrete, I mean at the integers, at points. And he found this formula, that it's the nth difference of some 2nth degree polynomial, so it's an nth degree polynomial, and it's the right one. Before that, or a much better known one, is the Legendre polynomials. They're the inner product that tests orthogonality is the integral. Instead of summing at the mesh points, we integrate over minus 1 to 1. And there's a famous formula for those polynomials. And they are orthogonal. Okay, so in other words, we're really speaking about classical things here, and there are explicit formulas for everything. And then there's a... So what are the properties of these things? Well, there are two properties of classical orthogonal polynomials that really deserve attention. And they are that there's a three-term recurrence formula, that the n plus first, nth, and n minus first polynomials are always connected by some beautiful formula, simple expression. Similarly for the Chebyshev discrete ones. So that's the most fundamental fact. Then this, out of that comes a formula that's in the books, and you just get excited about it when you see that you can use it, associated with Christoffel and Darboux. And what that formula does is what this example showed. The Christoffel-Darboux formula is the one that puts the pieces together and comes up and connects with gets the connection between that and that, that division by x. So I may go into more detail, but perhaps don't need to. Well, okay, here's a transparency with more formulas, but I'll just let me do the discrete one. So what am I seeing here in this mess of expressions? The Q's are these orthogonal columns, so that the best fit can be found by doing a one. Do you recognize in that as a one-dimensional projection, a projection on QJ for each J, and then you have to add them up. And then it's Christoffel Darboux that adds them up and shows that that's the answer. Fine. That there you see the bit of algebra. And I've now found it in the electrical engineering literature. A paper by a couple of German electrical engineers, Bromba and Ziegler, discovered that earlier. And then maybe one contribution is to consider the analogous one based on the Legendre polynomials with a similar formula. So we actually propose Legendre, partly because it's so close to Savitsky-Golay and because it's much simpler to work with. The formulas are a lot easier. Okay, so that's really the mathematics here. Let me summarize what, because I want to give Bromba and Ziegler, who first the references to their papers, which were back in the 80s, and then they carried it further by introducing weighted least squares. And that led them to other classical polynomials that I won't discuss here. But for me, the fascinating one was the limit of these weighted least squares produced something called the max flat filter, which is the one that wavelets are created from. So that Ingrid Dobashi, I noticed her 10 lectures on wavelets, the Siam book, which it's the bestseller in Siam's publishing history, is on the display table, and you'll find the particular filter there, which had been anticipated, but then Ingrid showed how to get wavelets out of it. Okay, so that's, and maybe I'll just mention, in case anybody knows about these max flat filters, then tracing down some of the references, the earliest reference I was happy to see was in a Siam journal, 66, the earliest I know of the filter that's the, what do I mean by max flat? Let me just make sense out of that statement. Max flat is the one where the derivative, you have as many zero derivatives as possible at zero there and at pi. That's the maximum flatness. And it's turned out to be a highly important filter in wavelets. Okay. Now, I think on this, with the remaining time, my goal is to say something about these last two topics. Our numerical experience, because of course if a filter's going to be considered, it's going to be tested. And we tested it on Gaussians. Let me just show you the result. So this is a first test of the filters. This is, I plotted the error. The error at the center, let's say. In goes a Gaussian plus noise. And I look to see what's the output from the Savitsky-Golay filter with different polynomial degrees, 0, 0, 2, 4, 6, the degree of the polynomial, as the length of the filter. You see, when you use the filter, you have to make a decision. How many points in a window? What should n be? And chemists learned very early that it was highly important to get n pretty near right. And this graph shows why. If n is taken too large, the error takes off. If n is taken too small, it's not good. There is an optimal n. Depends a little bit on the degree. And you may wonder, what are these curves? These are the errors from standard filters, from what are called equi-ripple filters, from the filters that electrical engineers like. And you see why they like them. They're more accurate. Except for some reason, which I have no idea, they get a bit worse just at the moment when Savitsky-Golay is better. And so the question arises, can we tell the user what filter length n to choose? So that's the sort of constructive part of the theory. It's fine to have a formula, speed up the calculation, but is the calculation giving something useful? And it clearly depends on n, and the chemists had figured that out. So they had a rule. Their value of n, learned by years of experience, was go halfway up the Gaussian, so half maximum, and take the width there. In other words, the value of n, so that you see the number of samples but in that interval is sort of appropriately matches the Gaussian. If the Gaussian is much wider, then n is bigger. If the Gaussian is very narrow, n is small. Narrow relative to the sampling rate. Okay, so they had that formula, and sure enough, that value of n, that full width at half maximum, is very close to these values. Of course, that rule doesn't distinguish between the degrees, 0, 2, 4, 6, or higher degree polynomial fit. So we hope to improve, to refine the rule, but the chemists basically discovered it. Can I mention one identity that came in our analysis of this question of optimal n? So I won't write down the equation for... So the equation for optimal n, optimal value of n, the equation, it's a messy equation, we don't know how to solve it. But one term in it was the integral from minus 1 to 1 of pn plus 1 of x over x all squared dx. You recognize why that might come in, because those are the filter coefficients. And we're estimating noise and variances, so it's not surprising that we're squaring it. And, we didn't expect to know what this number was. So we said, okay, give MATLAB a chance. And MATLAB computed that for several values of n, and the answer was 2. And it didn't change as n is even here. N is even. Those degrees 0, 2, 4, 6, 8, because we have symmetry here and we even polynomials. Anyway, well, once you know that the answer should be 2, then finding a proof isn't at all difficult using use the three-term recurrence. So I'm including this for anybody who knows and likes Legendre polynomials, recursion or recurrence formula. And to our knowledge, we haven't found it yet in the classical literature, but that literature is pretty enormous, so it could very well be there. And any expert in this area can prove it, but the question is, was it noticed before? Anyway, that helped out to simplify the equation a little, but we still have a transcendental equation for n optimal. Okay. And now, final topic is this fast recursion. Oh. Well, I see. When I say final topic, that means I haven't said anything about nonlinear filters. And the abstract mentioned median filters, and I feel I should say what those are. Can I switch for a moment to median filters? Because you might as well see, the idea there is so simple and sort of crude in a way, but it does its job on certain problems. So let me jump to nonlinear. The fast recursion. I'll just save for the last moment. What's the median? What's a median filter do? Let me take that example again. Suppose I have these five values. Now, so the linear filter weights those five values and comes out with a number. The median filter is nonlinear. It takes the median of the five numbers. So, I've created an example where I can't see what the median is. Can you, let's see, if I look up there, what's the median of those five? Let's see, it looks to me like maybe this one is slightly below this. So, do you think maybe that's the median? Okay. And then if I move over to the next window, I have the median of these, and this would be the median, right? So what's the use of this idea? This is the next median. This is the median in the zeroth window. And that would be the median in the first window. And then the median in the next window, well, I'd have to know what the next value was. And then it would be the median of this, 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 and this. Maybe it'd be here. Anyway, you see that with short, if I take three or five values, I can find the median very quickly. But if I take, like Savitsky-Golay, 101 values, and find the median of those, and then shift the window, and then find the median again, and then shift the window and find the median again, there's got to be a better way than doing all those median calculations independently, right? So my only comment on the median filters is that some thinking has to be done, and again, the MATLAB code for the median filter just does each one separately. And it's a very expensive filter if n is large. So that's the issue with median filters. How to execute them? How to? It's a combinatorial problem. What's a smart way to structure the data so that when you shift the window, you can compute the new median without starting from scratch. And I guess I should say, why do people use median filters and not ordinary linear filters? Well, the reason is, in some applications, a sample might come out there or here. And in ordinary linear filters, those ridiculous outliers are weighted like all the others, and they throw the answer way off. Whereas, what happens with a median filter to that value? It's ignored, right? That value will never be the median. So our median would always stay down here, even if we had this way off outlying sample. So medians are safer in that respect, more robust in that way, but more expensive, and I suppose really, if I try to bring ideas together here, I've been talking about one aspect of the data problem, the smoothing aspect, and just by example, you see some of the ideas that go into constructing filters, and some of the thinking that goes into making them fast. That's the problem that I haven't really discussed, but could report on a bit. So that's, here you're seeing one part of data processing, the smoothing. And some of the mathematics in the linear case connects back to classical polynomials. These other problems, classification, that really is mathematically new. And frankly, a lot of math departments, including my own, are not keeping up to date, so to speak. Words like hidden Markov model, support vector machine, neural net, there's a whole world of ideas because there's a whole range of new problems. And I suppose if I have a parting or final word, it is to say that that those problems can be fascinating. And they have the great advantage that they need new ideas, and probably those methods that I mentioned, those ideas that I mentioned, like support vector machine, it's undoubtedly not the final answer. But part of the fun in mathematics is in the problem, particularly in a new problem, and particularly in a problem with significant applications, for example, to biology and medicine and genomics. Okay, so there's a kind of connection between some very old mathematics and some mathematics that's still ahead of us. Thank you for inviting me to be here. Probably a large.
Yes, sir. Maybe we'll do this later. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thanks.
Let me make two announcements. And those who haven't met us, you can use the website now. And also, those whose names are on the waiting list for tonight's reception, the tickets are now available at the registration desk. So, see you at the reception at 7 o'clock.